Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
When Lance went on Oprah Winfrey and admitted being a drugs cheat, the Sunday Times said, "Thank you very much. We are now countersuing you."
It's episode 48 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is Melissa Reddy. Melissa is the senior football correspondent at the UK Independent, having previously worked for the likes of ESPN, Goal and Joe. She also has a new book out on Jurgen Klopp and Liverpool's title win. So we're going to get to that chat in just a moment, but a quick reminder to get in touch with the show. You can email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. I meant to mention this last week, but I have got a PDF doc collated with all of our guests' picks in terms of articles and books and so on across all of the previous 47 episodes. And given this seems a time in which we will all get a little bit more reading done, if you do want your hands on this list, then get in touch with me via the above channels. That is by far enough of me. Here's Melissa Reddy. Melissa, thanks so much for doing the show.
It's a pleasure.
So we'll talk about you first of all. Growing up in South Africa, tell us about what it was like and what kind of mark it has left on you.
I am fiercely proud to be South African. I think anyone that's ever met me or encountered me, that would be one of the first things they'd say. But it was actually very weird growing up in South Africa at a time where apartheid obviously shaped everything. And even when it was ended, the ramifications of it still took hold quite deeply. So where my family lived, the industries they could work in, that had all been dictated to them by the system. And I'd grown up with that already being entrenched. Trying to remove that was a very lengthy, very difficult process in which you also had to defy all logic and convention to not be what apartheid had designed non-white people to be. And so it's funny because my cousins remind me about this all the time now with, you know, the book and me doing a podcast and all the regular TV appearances. They always say, "Mal, when you were a kid, you had all this in your head." And I would put on radio shows and I would pretend I was on TV talking about sport. And they always say, "We don't know how you were able to dream all those dreams, because it wasn't possible. There was no pathway." And I think that's really one of the strengths of South Africa, that despite all it's been through, the success stories and the resilience of the people and of the place itself is remarkable.
Hmm. What did apartheid tell your family that they have to be, that they had to be?
Well, you could only work in specific industries. So you could work at petrol stations, you know, tending to the pumps, or if you were lucky, you'd work your way up to be manager of the petrol station, as an example, or you'd work in these large-scale clothing factories. Again, you'd start off small, you know, working on the floor and stuff, and then if you were lucky, you'd become a floor manager or a director of these factories. But you didn't really think of becoming a lawyer or a doctor, and even if you were really good at school, you had those things in your head, but it became apparent quickly that that wasn't available. You could do it you could be a doctor in the local community, but you couldn't be the doctor, that doctor, if that makes sense. And people really grew up entrenched in this is how we do things. This is how it works. This is what we're meant to do. This is where we're meant to live. This is the perception of us, and we kind of have to live with it. I come from a mixed family and a very, very political family that were freedom fighters. So my conditioning was different. I did think about possibilities. I did think about a brighter future. I didn't subscribe to this is what it's meant to be, and you have to rigidly stick to it. I was constantly fighting against that.
Your parents were freedom fighters. How did that manifest itself?
My family, entire family, uncles, aunts in general, were obviously directly affected by apartheid. So what happened in the local communities is they would start small charities to uplift the community. And then that spiraled into learning more and getting involved in political parties, because the political parties had the aim of equality for all, the African National Congress. And it was my uncle, my dad's oldest brother, who was really the main force in the family of educating everyone and pretty much sacrificing his life, his wife as well, at the time sacrificed her life to help the local community, but also make everyone aware that there is this future that we can work towards. There is this bigger picture. It's going to take a lot of struggle, a lot of pain, and there's going to be jail time, and you're not going to enjoy the whole process of pushing for it, but there will be light at the end of the tunnel. And it took a long, long, long time, but they were right.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to ask you one more question about your family, was there jail time in it for your members of your family as well?
Yeah, my uncle and aunt were in jail for a very long time. Loads of family friends, very, very close family friends, were in jail. My aunt was actually in jail while she was pregnant with my cousin, who's a year older than me. So that was obviously quite a taxing period. But I always ask them this, if they went back, would they do anything? Because they had to always evade the government. They were on the run. It wasn't comfortable. You didn't have a place to live for a while because they obviously couldn't go back home. And they say no, they wouldn't change anything. It was important for them to do what they had to do.
Did you feel like you were born at the right time, if that's not a silly question?
I think actually, because I've been thinking about the modern world as it is now with the advent of social media and all of that. And I'm very glad that I was in the middle, that I had a life without any of these kinds of pressures that kids are now under, with having to be, you know, look a certain way or behave a certain way or have a certain amount of followers or whatever, while also growing up at a time where the world was changing slowly, but it was changing. So I could see what it was. I could see how it was developing and then to what it is now. And it gave me a really good grasp of things. And I think importantly, it's kept me very grounded, and I appreciate things a lot. So
yeah.
I'll give you an example. I went to Paris for the first time I'd been to Paris was with work, on a Champions League trip. And I remember looking at the Eiffel Tower, and a memory from childhood came into my head of seeing it on TV and thinking, oh, would it be possible to ever go there? It seemed so distant to be a kid in South Africa who grew up in an underprivileged area to think of going to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower as something that could happen. So when I was there, I stopped and took it in, and I remembered that to be doing all the things I get to do now is just mind-blowing.
Yeah, it has happened, of course. How did it happen? Like, I mean, at what point, how did football first take hold in your life?
I have always been very sporty and into sport. My dad's side of the family, my cousin, who's a year older than me, used to play cricket. So I would go and watch him play. I'd play with him. My aunt used to coach physical education and run a mini softball team. So she used to do those clinics. I'd go to that with her. I used to be captain of the netball and volleyball teams. And after school, the guys would play football and I would want to play, and they'd always want to stick me in goal. So sport, the being involved in it and sort of playing it, always had a big appeal. And then during school holidays, I would, as I grew older, I started watching rugby, cricket, football, teaching myself the rules just from watching it and learning and reading. And I got really interested in finding out how things worked, how things were before, how they've evolved, and the deeper meaning behind stuff. Like why a bowler's technique was a certain way, or why trends in football were changing so often, which is a very nerdy thing, I think, as a young girl to be into. But that was me. And in South Africa, obviously, we don't have widely available resources. So we didn't have, for example, English football on TV all the time. It used to just be the FA Cup highlights. There used to be like a package show. And then later on, I remember we started getting the FA Cup live. But my granddad used to have these old tapes, old boxing tapes, football tapes, and all that. And I, when I used to visit them, I sit there and consume all that stuff. I should probably admit that I was also really into wrestling, as I think everyone was at one point. But yeah, I used to consume all of that and I was wowed by it. At the same time, I was very good at literature. I enjoyed writing. Writing was a massive passion. And when I was already in the third grade, my English teacher had said to me, if you aren't a writer, I will be disappointed because you understand the way words work. And then to obviously put those two together as a young female is not a very easy thing, because you don't see it. You don't see the possibility because you don't see people on TV that look like you doing it. You don't read articles where you see that it's been written by a female. And so when I went through university, even though I love sport and I would comment on it and everyone would say to me, you really should get into sport journalism, I actually had done media and communications with international relations and thought I was going to become a political journalist. Thank goodness I changed course. That would have not been an enjoyable life. But yeah, for a long time I was going down the politics route, and my gran actually had run for local office. So Thabo Mbeki, who was the president at the time, came to her house and I spoke to him about foreign policy. And so it was something that was really crystallized in my head that that would be a path for me. And I worked in like a TV company, but it used to produce business shows, and there was a lot of politics on that. And I remember having to produce these shows and be a part of it, thinking, no, there's absolutely zero enjoyment in this. This is not something I can spend so many years of my life doing. So then there was a whole bunch of odd jobs. There was writing press releases for Fashion Week and all these things that I didn't have any passion for, but you have to do as a young person who needs to make money to survive. And then I'd seen an opportunity in Cape Town for Team Talk, which was Sky Sports' South African operation at the time. They used to run a lot of websites that were under the B-Sky B umbrella. And so it meant changing cities because I was in Johannesburg at the time. I went for this very long interview process. You had to do a rewrite. You had to write an original. You had to do a quiz. And then there was the actual face-to-face interview. And when I'd done it, they said, we'll get in touch with you within 2 weeks to let you know if you've been successful or not. An hour after doing it, I got a call from the managing editor saying, we have not seen results like that. So if you wanted it, it's yours. It meant taking a pay cut. It meant doing the move. It meant like leaving my family and stuff behind. But I thought this is my shot. Like somebody's actually saying to me, we're giving you a chance to be a sports journalist. There is absolutely nothing. It doesn't matter about the money being less. It doesn't matter about the uncomfortable thing about having to move. I have to just take it. And it just kicked on from there. It was just all natural and all so rapid. And I can't imagine doing anything else, honestly.
That's a good thing to be able to say already. You obviously moved then to the UK. Did you spend long back in South Africa before you did move to the UK? And how big a jump was that?
Yeah, so the UK, I'd done a work trip at the end of 2013. And at the time I was considering moving either to Germany because my family had spent some time in Germany and the Bundesliga is quite a good league to cover. I could get a grip of the language, or I thought about Dutch football because I had a big interest in Dutch football, had done a lot of research and stuff around it. But if we're all being honest, the Premier League is the league. If you want to work in football, it's the one you aspire to work in because of its global reach. So while I was here on the trip, I thought I have to move heaven and earth to be able to work here. And it was immensely difficult. So I had originally come over as a chief European correspondent for the publication I was working for in South Africa. And rands to pounds does not translate very well. That's a start. But there were a lot of people who said, oh, you know, if you come over, we'll definitely find stuff for you to do. Oh, you're brilliant. We'd love having you on board. And then obviously when I was over there, like, oh, budgets and this and that. So yeah, the first few months, the first year or so was quite tricky. And then some things are just so poetic, but The Independent were the first publication to publish my articles in the UK. And obviously I'm now their senior correspondent. So it's nice how things work out sometimes. But it really all came together when Goal were constructing this correspondent space. So they wanted people with contacts at clubs to dedicate time to covering their club, knowing everything, all the ins and outs, exclusive interviews, breaking stories. And I think a lot of people look at Goal they look down on Goal basically because it's not national media, it's not a big broadcaster, it's just a website. But actually they had some really good ideas, a platform that reached something like 38 countries at the time when I worked there. And you'd have your work translated into all sorts of languages. It would get translated into Arabic and stuff like that. So you built a good audience of people worldwide who liked your writing style, were interested in what you were saying. And then from there, I went to Joe, which you guys obviously in Ireland will know well. And the reason I had joined them is because they allowed me to do, or they said I could do, the one thing I was really, really passionate about, which was long form writing. And so I was only at Joe for a year, but in that year, I did some of the work I'm proudest about, that I had time to pull together, that I could design the look and feel of it, and which also proved that I could do more than just Liverpool, because I think when you are working on a patch, you do get pinned down to that patch. People will only associate you with that. And I know even still, people will think predominantly of me being a very good source of Liverpool news, and that is true. But I'm able to show that I can cover big talking points, whether it's about racism in the game or the financial disparity or Arteta's rejuvenation of Arsenal, whatever it may be. I went to ESPN briefly as well, which then again taught me about the American style of relaying news, which was something different, something else to add to the armory. And yeah, now at the Independent, I couldn't be happier. It's such a good team. My editor is amazing, so accommodating. And I think as a journalist, that's so important to have somebody who allows your creativity and your artistic license, but who also accommodates the fact that you can do other things. I host my own podcast now, which is incredibly surreal. And I have a book that's just come out, which it's called Believe Us, and I can't believe it.
Let's talk about the book. So, Believe Us, How Jurgen Klopp Transformed Liverpool into Title Winners. Can you put your finger on exactly what makes this guy the leader that he is? Because I read so much testimony as to how great he is, and it's often expressed in the way that he always finds the right words for the right moment. I think that's how Klopp himself described leadership, but it's a very difficult thing to describe other than, you know, rely on the testimony that the people give and show the results of it.
Yeah, I think so being in his presence, when he says something, you believe it. You believe what he's saying because he believes it. And he delivers it in such a concise way. You pinpointed the right thing there, because all the players I spoke to for the book and the staff said the same thing, that he knows what to say, when to say it, and how to say it. So whether it be the teams in a highly emotional state, he knows how to calm them. When they are too calm and he needs to up the intensity, he knows how to do that. I think one of the things with Jurgen is because of how charismatic he is and magnetic on camera, and the hugs and, you know, the massive guffaw that he has, he's become this caricature that people see. And actually, he is very organized, very meticulous, actually quite risk averse in many senses, but he's very thoughtful. And when he's not on that touchline, he's able to divorce himself from the emotion. So when you read the book and it goes through certain team talks or the moments when Liverpool are at their lowest, so when they've lost the League Cup final, Europa League final, Champions League final, missing out on the league by a point, the things he says in those moments speak to how brilliant he is at, one, having the bigger picture in his head, but then making sure that he relays that bigger picture and getting everyone to buy into it and fully throw themselves into it. And then the other occasions is during team talk. So the team talk he gives before the Barcelona comeback, for example, the team talk he gives when Liverpool are at the Etihad in the Champions League, where the first half City are just hurricaning and torpedoing through them. How he just cuts through that and is the calmest man in the dressing room and says, just do what we do. Just play our football. It's okay. Yes, they're a brilliant team. They had to play like that in that half. They did all of that, and yet we're still in this game. So now let's go and take the game away from them. There's so many aspects to him that make him unique, but I think actually a lot of it has the basis in his own upbringing, that as a child and through trying to become a professional footballer, which he only did at 23, he had to come a lot of adversity, which again happened through his managerial career, missing out on promotion with Mainz due to goal difference, due to points, missing out on European qualification with Borussia Dortmund, losing the Champions League final, then obviously the defeats and finals I spoke about at Liverpool. And so he's become really good at losing, which has made him become really good at winning, because he understands how to handle both aspects to not get too caught up into either of them. And I think the other thing I would emphasize about him is his human touch. He cares about the people he comes into contact with regularly, not just players and staff, but everyone that's been in his vicinity. And I'll give you the example of Jamie Webster, the electrician, a Liverpool electrician who started playing Liverpool gigs around the city for Boss Nights. And Jürgen had watched these Boss Night videos on YouTube and wanted the club to get more involved with him, because he thought, oh, this is such a cool story. A local lad that has this passion, that's creating these songs for us. Jamie Webster got invited on the club's West tour. Klopp surprised him there. It's at the point now where Jamie Webster's released a debut album. He doesn't have to be an electrician anymore. He can now focus on music because of Klopp taking an interest in him, getting the club to invest in him, supporting him. And when the album came out, Klopp's got a copy and he sent Jamie Webster a message about it, saying, you know, he's so happy that he's pursued his dreams. And I think that has been one of the biggest takeaways for me in the 5 years that I've worked with him, is his influence stretches beyond just the football club. He's able to touch the lives of so many other people like Jamie.
And exactly, to build on that point, like he fits the mold very well of a perfect manager in British football, like Shankly, like Ferguson, like Steen, like Clough, etc. This kind of totemic figure at the top of everything. But when you read the book, you realize he's not quite the kind of authoritarian manager that you sometimes think, like certainly that Ferguson was, or the other managers that have been successful in Britain. Because as you show at the beginning of the book, like Brendan Rodgers didn't work because he wouldn't work within the transfer committee, as it was doom-ladenly called at the time. So there were these weird compromises where Roberto Firmino would be signed, but then Christian Benteke had to be signed as well. Like two players in the same position who play in totally different ways that made no sense. Whereas Klopp was much more of a democrat in the sense he'd slot in and would happily work with the people around him.
From day one, his first meeting with the staff, where they had all expected him to lay down the law to them. This is how we're going to do things moving forward. This is how I like to work. And actually the meeting was, so guys, tell me all about what you do and tell me how it works here. What do we do on a match day? What's our training plans? What's the media landscape looking like? And they were like, oh no, you tell us. And he was like, no, you tell me. I've come here to work in this country, in this league, at this club. you guys have been here and done it, so you tell me, I need to learn. And I think that just set the tone then for everything. He loves people to take responsibility for their departments. You're in charge of it. Make big decisions. Yes, we may have disagreements about it, but he will respect you for saying, for this department, this is the best call. And you spoke there about that transfer committee, which was so derided. And when you think it's the exact same people that are in charge now, that are same, no change except Ian Eyre departing.
That's interesting. I assume that there had been changes, but it is actually the same people. They just haven't called themselves a committee. I assumed a couple of heads might have rolled.
The only change was when Ian Eyre's contract was up and he left, but Michael Edwards was being groomed for the position of sporting director, and he had been operating in that guise anyway. And the change was that now there was a manager working within the system, obviously a world-class manager, who had a very clear stylistic profile for the scouts and stuff to work towards, but a man who was happy to sort of listen to recommendations and take them on board. And the example of that would be, he really wanted Julian Brandt because he knew Julian quite well. He'd done a lot of research. Obviously, his contacts in the Bundesliga are excellent. But Brandt knew he wouldn't be a certified starter at Liverpool, and he didn't want to make that step too soon. And Michael Edwards said to him, we're wasting time here. We should go and get Mo Salah. His numbers have been extraordinary, and it's only the tip of what he can do. He's so far away from his ceiling. And so he's like, okay, yes, let's go and get Mohamed Salah. Whereas in the past, there would have been so much friction about the manager not getting who he wanted. And I think that's one of the big key points of where you see what a difference a manager who comes in, who's right for everything. So right because he has worked with sporting directors before, so he enjoys that kind of relationship. Right because he didn't expect to come in and blow transfer budgets. He wanted to develop what he had, right? Because he knew that there would be no instant, immediate success. It would need to be a process. But he had the evidence behind him because of what he had done at Mainz and Borussia Dortmund to convince people, the staff, the players, the ownership, that he was the man to make sure Liverpool went on this journey and reached the ambitions and the objectives that they wanted. And obviously, really early on, there was evidence that something special was brewing, that Europa League run in 2016, but also the away games they had at Manchester City and Stamford Bridge. You could tell there were building blocks to something if they could get in better recruitment, shore up defense, which obviously happened in a step-by-step process. They bring in the first transformer, which is Sadio Mane, and he then gives Liverpool the template of, okay, we need to replicate that on the other flank. So they get Mo Salah, and then the defensive spine of the team, Fabinho, Virgil van Dijk, and Alisson, to create now this behemoth. But people will say Liverpool spent money, and they did on those players that I've mentioned. But when you look at the wastage at other clubs, and when you look at the players that have improved so dramatically, Roberto Firmino, for example, was considered flop of the season just before Jürgen came in, and now he's seen as one of the most intelligent number nines in the game. And Trent Alexander-Arnold's opportunity and the way he's matured into the team. Andy Robertson was signed from Hull. You know, people were so underwhelmed by that. Mo Salah was called a Chelsea reject. Even Mane, when Liverpool signed Mane, and as somebody who covers the transfers from start to finish, I know the reactions. People were not happy that Liverpool was spending £30 million on somebody from Southampton that they thought was nowhere near the quality required to be a Liverpool player. So the development of individuals and that collective unit has been staggering.
Yeah, he talks a little bit about insecurity in the book. Like, he talked about when he first walked into the Liverpool dressing room, he was beseeching the players, only listen to criticism from me and the coaches. The outside noise doesn't matter. But he reflects in your book that it's probably rooted in a kind of insecurity in the sense, like, when a manager is in bother, he'll throw everyone else under the bus. He'll sack everyone to save himself. And it's interesting with Klopp, there's a kind of total security there. And that even comes with trusting the people around you to work with them in the, like, the transfer committee and those kind of people. I think that there's probably more security there than there was with Rodgers. And just, this is quite on the nose comparison, but I'm sure you and all of our listeners have seen that wretched documentary Being Liverpool, but we'll all remember the big portrait of Brendan Rodgers in his house. There is actually a portrait of Klopp at the training ground, but the difference being, it's, as you reveal in the book, it's made up of the names of everyone who works in the training ground. So I think that's a little bit of an on-the-nose symbolism there.
Yeah, the picture was really a way to say he is the face of everything Liverpool are doing, but he wouldn't be able to achieve his success without everyone at that training pitch that makes things happen. And I worked covering the club prior to his arrival, and I'd been at Anfield and felt the toxicity in the air and the division. Everything was divided. The fan base, at Melwood, you could feel the tension, the unease, the unhappiness. And now you walk in there and everyone's bouncing. The feel of the place is completely different. And the insecurity and the psychology of the players was one of the biggest things he needed to change. Because when he walked in, they felt that they didn't deserve to be at Liverpool. And there was obviously the weight of not being anywhere close to winning the title. And that's what everybody associated with the club was so desperate for. And Adam Lallana actually talks about it in the book, where you wear that with you all the time. You can't switch it on and off. And Klopp had to really shake that out of the players, tell them that carrying that around is not going to help you with your performances. It's not going to help you with your mental health. It's not going to help you achieve anything. You have to be free from that to fulfill your potential. And I think in terms of the players and the staff and even the supporters, when they saw how much he was giving of himself and how much trust and faith and belief he was, you know, willing to share in the players, in the club itself, in the process, then everybody found it quite easy to get with it and to sort of push forward. There were obviously moments where externally there were a lot of question marks. The 2-2 draw with West Brom, where he walks the players over to the cop to thank the fans, and that's seen as Jurgen Klopp is making this once great institution celebrate mediocrity. But it goes to the point I mentioned earlier. He's got the bigger picture in his head. And so he's able to ignore all the noise because he knows what he's doing and what it's going to lead to in future. And he's gotten the players to think that way as well, which is why one of their biggest characteristics has been how they react to setbacks, the strength they show whenever they've had a massive knock with losing the finals and stuff. oh, just go back and win the Champions League. Oh, just go back and stroll the English top flight and be crowned champions. So it's really incredible how when I was writing the book and having to, because you tend to forget as it happens, because football is so instantaneous and there's so much going on and you're always having to react to what's happening now. You lose a sense of how it was. So when I was writing the book, to remember those games at Anfield, sitting there feeling the tension in the crowd, remembering what the online conversation was like, remembering how poisonous it had all become. It wasn't fun to work on the club or be involved in the club in any way. And for one man to walk in and keep pretty much the same staff and work within the parameters of what was there and transform it so much is really a credit to the work he does.
They've responded to the setbacks of losing finals, etc. Melissa, how the hell are they going to respond to the setback of losing Virgil van Dijk for a whole season?
I think this is their greatest challenge now, because they have dealt well with the loss of players in recent history. So when Felipe Coutinho goes, he was Liverpool's gold dust at the time. He was their key player. He was their main man and their biggest asset. And they were in such a positive period. They were preparing for their first Champions League knockout since 2009. And the ownership was scared that selling Coutinho mid-season at that point when everything was looking so rosy would really derail the club. And Jürgen was the one saying, no, he wants to go. We'll sell him. It's not going to help the team to keep him here. We'll sell him, we'll reinvest, and we'll go again, because the group of players I have are big enough, are responsible enough, are hungry enough to absorb his loss and just become better. And obviously we know what happens from that point on after Coutinho goes to Barcelona. When they lost Alisson at the start of last season, Liverpool had reported to pre-season training with that attitude of, we don't care what happens this season, that's our title. Andy Robertson speaks about it, Jordan Henderson speaks about it. They were so focused and so resolute in this idea of, we're just going to go out there and try and win every single game and deal with every single thing that comes our way. Because if we can get 97 points and push City so close, we can overhaul them. And that was probably the confidence of winning the Champions League and now finally knowing what it feels like to have that silverware and such a major piece of it. That Alisson's injury happening so soon into this phase of being so focused that they just got on with it and they just carried on winning and winning and winning. Virgil, but they were winning and winning and winning, and they had Virgil van Dijk.
Yeah, and they signed Virgil van Dijk when Coutinho left as well. Like, he's the key guy, really, in all of this.
Yeah, Virgil has an aura that is very hard to explain. You look at him and there's a safety and a security and an assurance about him. And his ability to organize that defense and to also the psychological impact on his teammates as him being a reference point for them, but also on the opposition who continuously target the right side because they don't want to have to bother dealing themselves with getting past Virgil van Dijk. That has now been removed from the equation. You've lost that psychological effect, but you've also lost the guy that is the best in the league in the air, that is an absolute machine in the amounts of minutes he racks up. Before he was forced off the pitch in the derby, he played every minute of the 74 league games prior to that for Liverpool. You're losing the guy who is the best at duels in the league. And you now are exposed in those respects, but also with the opposition thinking, haha, we now no longer have that Virgil van Dijk headache. So it throws up a variety of problems. And when you sort of spell this out, I think people get annoyed because they say, hang on, you're doing the rest of the team a disservice or the rest of the defense a disservice. And it's not that, it's just explaining that this is, he's not just any player. He is really, really, really good and really, really, really important. And with Alisson already missing and with Joel Matip and Joe Gomez so injury prone, and with Fabinho the only other option, it is a severe blow for Liverpool to deal with. And I think, you know, Jürgen referred to them as mentality monsters. And I know he speaks to them when Coutinho left and when Alisson was injured, is don't give people on the outside a reason to say that your season ended with this setback. You have the power. You decide now what happens next. And if Liverpool can cope with losing Virgil van Dijk for months, which, if we're being honest, is the majority of the season, if not all of the season, then wow, that is some achievement. Because when you have centre-backs that have played the game and midfielders and loads of people that have been involved in the game, even managers saying they've not seen a defender like him in a long time, I think it speaks to the influence he has.
Yeah, definitely. We'll move on from that, Melissa. The book is available now and it's really very, very good. I would recommend it to everyone listening. We'll zoom through a couple of your picks. One of which is Nick Hornby's fever pitch. Can you tell us a little bit about why you picked it?
I remember reading it thinking I hadn't really... there wasn't really a fan perspective before in that detail that spoke to how insane it is to be a fan, you know, because you're so emotionally invested in these men kicking a ball around. But that at the same time, how much fandom is an escape for everything you're dealing with, whether it be parents' divorce or whatever is happening in life that is unpalatable at whatever stage. And how much of your development in life is also linked, that you can link it back to, you know, oh, that football match was happening and this was also happening in my life at the time. So that was quite an interesting and fresh slant on things, and also made me think about the whole concept of being a fan differently.
Mm. I remember this book chiefly because of Gus Caesar. I don't know, do you remember the right back? So this is really interesting. Nick Hornby made me think about this, and it's never really left me as a writer and a journalist. He makes it like Gus Caesar was a reserve right back. He didn't play very often for Arsenal, was a joke figure, like was totally derided by the fans as not being fit to wear the shirt, like called a Sunday league player, totally out of his depth. And Nick Hornby makes the point, well, hang on a minute, like Gus Caesar was the best player in his club, like growing up at all the age groups, he was the best player. He's the best player in his school, the best player in his locality. He's the best player in the surrounding region. He was good enough to get this far. And now he's being, you know, made out as being totally out of his depth. Like, it just goes to show the standard that these people are playing at is almost unthinkable at times.
And you know what? We're actually making those same points, because I'd seen the same thread on Twitter a couple of days ago saying this, like, players at the elite level are not, as our mentions will often say, shit or shite. They really aren't, guys. Like, for them to be on the fringes of these elite teams is absolutely no joke. The level is ridiculously, ridiculously, ridiculously high. And I know it's easy to sit on a couch and think you could play better than somebody that's involved in elite football, but it's definitely easier in your head.
And it's given me major imposter syndrome as a journalist and a writer. Like, here I am writing, critiquing these guys. It's like, ooh, maybe my words don't carry the weight I like to think they have. The other, we'll skip on to another article that you picked, Melissa, by Sid Lowe, writing about Lionel Messi in 2010. So it's written in March 2010. Messi's just scored a hat-trick in a 4-2 league win over Real Zaragoza. He also won a penalty and handed it over to Zlatan Ibrahimovic as an act of charity. Tell us a little bit about this piece and why you picked it.
So I was very young at this point and learning about my own writing style and learning about what I found quite challenging in terms of writing and sport. One of the things that is so tough is to write about something that's repetitive. So, for example, when a player is just that good, to write about him just being that good every week or every few days, like, what more can you say, right? There really isn't, like, you're like trying to open yourself up, fiddling around, looking for new descriptions, trying to think of something smart. And that Sid Lowe piece, imagine having to write about Messi at that period, having to write about him all the time. And honestly, read the way it starts. And then every single time I'm stuck, I still have the habit of going back and reading that piece to think, Mel, you're not stuck. Sid Lowe was sitting there having to write about Leo Messi in his prime, and he came up with that. So you can rustle something up. Come on. It is an example of admitting, gosh, this is really difficult to do now, in the most poetic way. It's a magnetic piece. It draws you in and it just keeps you in. And it's telling you about something you know. Yes, you know Messi's the dog's bollocks, but it's telling it to you in a way you haven't heard before. And that is a gift.
Yeah, it would be easier to write about Gus Caesar. I'll read the intro. It's not big and it's not clever, but sometimes swearing is the only thing that will do. Sometimes you've used up every other word and nothing else quite hits the spot. You've rummaged around the back of the sofa, rifled through the drawers, turned out your pockets, and still come up empty. Pep Guardiola insisted that he was clean out of adjectives, and frankly, so was everyone else. Spain was suffering a severe shortage of superlatives last night. The Catalan newspaper Sport invited readers to send in headlines for what they had just witnessed. And there are plenty of super sensational and sublimes, some magic, magnificent and marvellouses, wows and wonderfuls, plus deities by the dozen, and even a supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. But still, there was no way to really do it justice. No polite way anyway. Just wide eyes, a wider mouth, and a simple, holy shit. Which is great. And this, by the way, was written in 2010. He's had another 10 years of this.
I know. And it was the first thing that came to my mind when I was asked for something, because I know how often I've gone to read it. Because as I've explained, it would have been he would have probably been sitting there thinking, oh gosh, why did you have to go and score another hat-trick, Messi? Come on, why have you done this to me? And yet it is insanely brilliant. And still, so you read it today and you're like, yeah, it feels like you're watching that Messi in all his glory again. And I think I really am a fan of writers who, when you're reading their stuff, you feel like you were there. Mm. Whether that is they're doing an interview, you feel like you're sitting there in the interview being a part of this process, or describing a certain moment in a game, or describing that performance from Messi. Every time I read it, it feels like I was at the stadium watching him.
Mm. Hugh McElvanny, I know you picked him as well. He has that same quality in writing. I know there's a piece on George Best and he talks about watching him from the press box, and some guy was doing a match report and he roars out, oh, at what time did that goal go in? And McElvanny turns around and says, never mind the time, write down the date.
Yeah, exactly. His work, it speaks to that, the ability to make you feel like you were there, like you were involved, but it's got such an ease about it and also such a power about it. And the way he was able to draw perspectives out of personalities that we might have otherwise not have read or known was really remarkable. Anything he writes, and even now when you go back, the George Best piece that you speak about, when you go back and read it now, you're reading it and you're like, whoa. and I think the other thing about him is he never personally advertised himself as some heavyweight of this industry. It was always other people who would read his stuff and be like, this guy is a man, where I think there are others who were the opposite, who did really market themselves as doyens of sports writing. But yeah, I would implore anyone that's listening, if you're not familiar with this stuff, maybe it's a bit dated for you or you're a bit younger, go and read it. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it really doesn't date at all. Melissa, we're nearly out of time. I will ask you the couple of stock questions we ask everyone as we reach the end of the podcast. Who is the most interesting person you've met with work, if we haven't mentioned him already?
It would be Diego Maradona.
Oh, yes.
At the 2010 World Cup. And it's so weird. When I grew up, I told you I had old tapes. So I was, from a very early age, all Team Maradona. And I loved the fact that he was fallible, that he was so imperfect, that he was so human, that he made so many mistakes. I know, obviously, that's all the things that I held up against him. But it sort of resonated. He just felt real. And so at the 2010 World Cup, being involved, like being in the press conferences, getting to ask him questions, watching him up close, it was such a weird feeling. It was surreal. Even the simplest things he did had this magic about it. And it's quite hard to explain. I did an interview with Maurizio Pochettino on the Behind the Lines podcast. And Pochettino used to room with Maradona. And obviously, growing up in Argentina, Maradona was Pochettino's idol. And he speaks about not sleeping when they roomed together, because he would ask him so many questions and Maradona would have all these stories. And Poch says, the thing about Diego is he was never Diego Maradona. He was such a down-to-earth, kind, accessible person who still, to this day, invests so much into Poch and his family, which I think is something that we don't ordinarily associate with Maradona. I wouldn't have, of all the things I thought about Maradona, I wouldn't have thought that. So that was good to get a sort of different look at him.
Yeah, absolutely. He was Argentina manager at that time. And where is the most interesting place you've been with work?
There have been loads, but I think the one that was nicest, or the trip that immediately came into my head, was Sevilla. I've done the US tours, I've done Hong Kong, and I've walked down, you know, the side streets with the live markets and stuff, which was quite the experience. I've been to Qatar, which was weird. And also selling animals in the heat was not something I wanted to see. But Sevilla is a really nice place if people have never been. It is so understatedly pretty, and the food is ridiculously good. We were eating Michelin star quality food at one of those restaurants near the garden, and it was like €5 for a plate, and I was like, what is this heaven? So I've been to loads of places, but that trip always sticks out in my mind because it wasn't what I expected, I think. And if people are looking for somewhere to go in Europe, I would really suggest Sevilla.
Melissa, thanks so much for doing the show. It was really great.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Melissa, and thanks to you for listening and for supporting the show and the 42 as a whole. We do really greatly appreciate it. Look after yourself, keep safe, and we're going to be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.